morning, everyone. Awake and ready?
Yes.
Great. You please pray with me. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
I bow at your feet
and surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the powerful perfection
of Thy almighty presence. Sparkling in every cell of my being.
I feel my intelligence.
Awaken to thy guiding wisdom.
Every part of me.
Is saturated in thy healing grace. I live in thee.
I live for thee.
I live eternally in thee. Tuesday, January the 5th, we mark the anniversary of Master's birth into this world. Reading from the Gita commentary, the expanded commentary, The Battle of Life, Master talks about the very inception of life from a physical standpoint. From the very moment of conception to the surrender of the last breath, man has to fight in each incarnation innumerable battles, biological, hereditary, bacteriological, physiological, climatic, social, ethical, political, sociological, psychological, metaphysical, so many varieties of inner and outer conflicts. Competing for victory in every encounter are the forces of good and evil. The whole intent of the Gita is to align man's efforts to the side of Dharma, or righteousness. The ultimate aim is self-realization, the realization of man's true self, the soul, as made in the image of God, one with the ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss of spirit. The first contest of the soul in each incarnation is with other souls seeking rebirth, with the union of the sperm and ovum to begin the formation of a new human body. A flash of light appears in the astral world, the heavenly home of souls between incarnations. That light transmits a pattern which attracts a soul according to that soul's karma, the self-created influences from actions of past lives. In each incarnation, karma works itself out partly through hereditary forces. The soul of a child is attracted into a family in which heredity is in conformance with the child's past karma. Many souls vie to enter the new cell of life. Only one will be victorious. In the case of multiple conception, more than one primal cell is present. With the mother's body, the unborn child struggles against disease, darkness, and periodic feelings of limitation and frustration as the soul consciousness in the unborn child remembers and then gradually forgets its greater freedom of expression during its astral sojourn. The soul within the embryo also has to contend with karma, which is influencing for good or ill the formation of the body in which it is now a resident. Additionally, it encounters the vibratory influences that reach it from the outside, the environment and actions of the mother, external sounds and sensations, vibrations of love and hate, peace and anger. After birth, the struggles of the infant are between its instincts to seek comfort and survival and the opposing relative helplessness of its immature bodily instrument. A child begins his first conscious struggle when he has to choose between his desires to play aimlessly and his desire to learn, study, and pursue some course of systematic training. Gradually, more serious battles arise, forced upon him by karmic instincts from within or by bad company and environment from without. The youth finds himself confronted suddenly with a host of problems that often he has been ill-prepared to meet. Temptations of sex, greed, prevarication, money-making by easy but questionable means, pressure from the company he keeps and social influences. The youth usually discovers he possesses no sword of wisdom with which to fight the invading armies of worldly experiences. The adult who lives without cultivating and employing his innate powers of wisdom and spiritual discrimination finds inexorably that the kingdom of his body and mind is being overrun by the insurgents of misery-making wrong desires, destructive habits, failure, ignorance, disease, and unhappiness. Few men are even aware that a state of constant warfare exists in their kingdom. Usually it is only when the devastation is nearly complete that men helplessly realize the sad ruin of their lives. The psychological conflict for health, prosperity, self-control, and wisdom has to be started anew each day in order for man to advance towards victory, reclaiming inch by inch the territories of the soul occupied by the rebels of ignorance. The yogi, the awakening man, is confronted not only with the external battles fought by all men, but also the internal clash between the negative forces of restlessness arising from manas, or the sense consciousness mind, and the positive power of his desire and effort to meditate, supported by buddhi, intelligence. When he tries to reestablish himself in the soul's inner spiritual kingdom, the subtle centers of life and divine consciousness in the spine and the brain. The Gita therefore points out in its very first stanza the prime necessity to man for nightly introspection, that he may clearly discern which force, the good or the evil, has won the daily battle. To live in harmony with God's plan, man must ask himself each night the ever-persistent question, gathered together on the sacred bodily tract, the field of good and evil actions, what did my opposing tendencies do? Which side won today in the ceaseless struggle? The crooked, tempting, evil tendencies and the opposing forces of self-discipline and discrimination, come now, tell me, what did they do? The yogi, after each practice of concentrated meditation, asks his power of introspection, assembled in the region of consciousness, in the cerebral spinal axis on the field of the body's sensory activity, eager for battle, the mental sense faculties that try to pull the consciousness outward, and the children of the soul's discriminative tendencies that seek to reclaim the inner kingdom, what did they? Who won this day? Reading from the autobiography of a yogi. Chapter 1. The characteristic features of Indian culture have long been a search for ultimate verities and the concomitant disciple-guru relationship. My own path led me to a Christ-like sage whose beautiful life was chiseled for the ages. He was one of the great masters who are India's sole remaining wealth. Emerging in every generation, they have bulwarked their land against the fate of Babylon and Egypt. I find my earliest memories covering the anachronistic features of a previous incarnation. Clear recollections came to me of a distant life, a yogi amidst the Himalayan snows. These glimpses of the past, by some dimensionless link, also afforded me a glimpse of the future. Oh, the helpless limitations and humiliations of infancy are not banished from my mind. I resentfully conscious of not being able to walk or express myself freely. Prayerful surges arose within me as I realized my body impotence. My strong emotional life took silent forms as words in many languages. Among the inward confusion of tongues, my ear gradually accustomed itself to the circumambient Bengali syllables of my people. The beguiling scope of an infant's mind, adultly considered limited to toys and toes. Psychological ferment in my unresponsive body brought me to many obstinate crying spells. I recall the general family bewilderment at my distress. Happier memories, too, crowd in on me, my mother's caresses, and my first attempts at lisping phrase and toddling step. These early triumphs, usually forgotten quickly, are yet a natural basis of self-confidence. My far-reaching memories are not unique. Many yogis are known to have retained their self-consciousness without interruption by the dramatic transition from life and death. If man be solely a body, its loss indeed places the final period to identity. But if prophets down the millenniums spake with truth, man is essentially of incorporeal nature. The persistent core of human egoity is only temporarily allied with sense perception. Although odd, clear memories of infancy are not extremely rare, during travels in numerous lands, I have listened to early recollections from the lips of voracious men and women. I was born in the last decade of the 19th century and passed my first 8 years at Gorakhpur. This is my birthplace in the United Province of northeastern India. And so begins this life, which he then continues, of course, in his wonderful autobiography, a great gift to all of us. And so this great God-man incarnated into this world, and we are all the grateful recipients for everything that he brought. I remember traveling in India and watching there the men, the fathers and sons, and men friends, and just what a familiar kind of relationship they seemed to have with each other. It was startling sometimes to see soldiers with guns at rest on their laps and holding hands or leaning on each other, very physically kind of comfortable with each other in that way. And the warmth and the of family there is so great. And I thought of Master traveling here to America, something he felt inwardly prompted to do. And of all places, he ended up in Boston. Not only physically a cold place, but also I would imagine at that time a great formality. Dr. Lewis, one of Master's earliest and great disciples, always wore his hat, always wore a vest and a jacket. There is a formality there, both in dress and language and habits. And so coming from a warm climate with warm relationships to what I would also imagine was oftentimes a suspiciousness. What does this man from India want from us? Is he just money-seeking? Is he a charlatan? Oftentimes at that time, yogis were associated for some reason with gazing at crystal balls and being able to tell the future and all kinds of magical charms. Master came, of course, as a ripe fruit. He was not just partially ripe. He had attained in his consciousness the ability to transcend the limitations of body and the senses and rise into an infinite expanse of consciousness. This was the great gift that he brought, the promise. It was a promise made by Jesus that man and God may merge and become as one. There is a great debate within 100 years after the death of Jesus whether Jesus was a man who became a God or whether he was a God who became a man. That's an interesting debate to have. And with an avatar, we would say God becomes man. But through the play of an avatar, which means divinity descent into flesh, within an avatar's life and within his lila and play, he may take on a period of ignorance. Anandi Moyama, for instance, who she and Master met and is beautifully described in the autobiography, she came with complete knowledge and understanding of who she was as one in God. Master also came with so many memories of a meditating Himalayan yogi, and he yearned to get back to that life, but that was not to be his in this lifetime. He ultimately was to come to Sri Yukteswar, who was to direct him back out into the world. A stunning paradox for many who are seeking to go beyond the limits of this world. But Ma came, and she was one in that ecstatic experience from the very beginning. And in the beginning, many family members and others were very worried about her because she didn't interact in the same way that other children did. They thought that she may have some brain damage. They thought that she might be mentally ill. There is different speculations as to what might be wrong with her because she didn't play and interact with others because she was already absorbed into the divine essence. It was only later in life that she voluntarily gave up her oneness with the omniscience in order to practice sadhana. And for 7 years, she experienced the separation, the longing, the loneliness, and the intense aspiration to reach God. Now, you may ask, why would a person ever choose to consciously let go of their God consciousness? And the reason, of course, are many. A great master such as that may be helping to work out the karma of others. As Mother said, she did this in order to take on these various levels of ignorance so that she could easily identify with whoever came before her, because she had gone through that kind of ignorance. She had gone through that kind of separation, loneliness, habits. Everything that we've had to face, she had to face. And so Master Tu came into this world. Now, it may seem stunning to some that there are so many incarnations, so many avatars. And an avatar can be a soul who has achieved complete union with God, but they choose to come back into this realm in order to help humanity who is striving for such a lofty goal. But as Mother explained, both she and Master came at the time that they did, because the world was emerging out of the Kali Yuga. There's a 200-year cusp between the Kali Yuga and coming fully into the Dwapara Yuga. 1899 was the end of that 200-year cusp date. And now we are fully into the Dwapara Yuga, and for the previous 200 years, we had seen an immense acceleration in the intelligence of man in terms of science, in terms of technology. There is huge growth during that time of the understanding of the cosmos we live in and how to empower ourselves within it. But man was about to burst on into the 20th century, and with that came tremendous danger. Mother explained that there are two great cycles. There's a smaller cycle, of which we were just coming out of the Kali Yuga. There is a larger cycle in which we are also at the apex of the Kali Yuga. So this was a very difficult Kali Yuga. in relationship to perhaps other Kali Yugas. It was a very dark time. And so you had despots, you had viciousness, man against man, and it's bad enough when you have a sword in your hand, but when you have atomic weapons, when you have ICBM missiles and other kinds of weapons of mass destruction, just a few people with that kind of power can cause such devastation. And so Master and Mother came at that time specifically to help, because this Kali Yuga was such a terrible, difficult time that we were coming out of, that we were having this concurrence of great rapidity of development of man's intelligence, but not his wisdom. He also needed scientific tools in order to advance his spiritual wisdom and attunement, because knowledge without wisdom can be a very dangerous weapon. So this was a very, very important time for them to come. And when you think about the possibilities of all the ways things could have gone differently, it's a terrifying prospect. It was a difficult enough time as it was. But ultimately, we can say, at least thus far, the more positive forces have prevailed over the more negative. But it's still a battle royal. And it continues on all around us. And the dangers are still there, but we have certainly dodged a very large bullet of the 20th century. Now, there are heroes for those positive forces that are known to the world. But there are others who operate behind the scenes. And they are no less heroic and no less important. In fact, they are more essential, more important. Because through the silent prayers and influence of great God-attuned individuals, it can help to influence this world for the good. Master said a very interesting thing one time. He said that it was Jesus and Babaji operating through Hitler's own desire nature that prompted him to invade Russia. And you'd think, well, they helped to start a war between these two countries? But it is said that 80% of that battle was fought between the Russian front and the German front. And so the ultimate victory of the more positive forces in this case could have only come about in that way. And much worse destruction, much worse could have come about if that had not occurred. So these are tremendous things that we see, but both with Master and Mother, paying a karmic debt within their own beings, within their own bodies, taking that on. Master suffered terrifically towards the end of his life. He could not walk. Oftentimes, he had to be carried in a chair. Mother had the same thing. I remember when we were meeting at Bonnie's, and there was a period of time when Mother could not even walk up the steps in order to get into Bonnie's. And I and another individual would take a chair down and sit it down, and Mother would sit in it. We had the privilege of carrying her up those steps. Now, we could carry her body, but we could not carry her karma. That was only something Mother could do. I had a profound experience once in which I was having a vision with Mother. And in this vision, which happened in a superconscious dream, we were sitting and we were talking, and I could tell that Mother was not feeling well. She was not her normal vivacious kind of self, you could say. And I complained a little bit in my mind. Oh, I wish that Mother were feeling better and, you know, we could have a nicer time of it. And suddenly, as I had this meandering thought go through my mind, a very ungrateful thought, by the way, I felt a heaviness starting to come on me that gradually built. And I just felt this heaviness is like a huge weight and so much pain that came with it. And as that weight began to cascade on top of me, Mother got brighter and cheerier and brighter, and she was laughing and joking, and I felt like I was going to be crushed right there on the floor. And then finally, when I didn't think that I could take it any longer, it gradually began to lift off of me. And as it did so, Mother's countenance became more stern, and I understood a little bit of what she was carrying, what she was taking on for disciples and for this world, so that we might not have to face all the consequences of our own actions and the collective actions of this world. And so Master and Mother came for that purpose. And Master came to this West at great sacrifice to himself in order to help to awaken original Christianity, awaken that innate knowledge that we know somewhere deep inside of us, but we're so very afraid to acknowledge, that God in Christ exists right within us, is ready to awaken within us. Jesus was crucified, as the story goes, because he proclaimed such a thing. And Master was crucified as well, and Mother was crucified as well. And the crucifixion continues. Man can dare believe that he has divinity existing within him. And I offer as proof that even those of us who are dedicated towards this path, how inconstant we are towards that goal. It denotes our own disbelief. If we truly believed, if we truly felt that God was emerging within us, would we not do everything possible in order to let that birth come into this world, within our own beings, within our own body, within our own lifetime? It is a great canard that's been foisted upon this world that you have to wait until some time after death before you learn the truth. But tell me, what virtue is there in dying? Does not everybody leave the body and die? There's no great virtue in this. Therefore, why would you get the pearl of great price of realization just because you die? You take yourself with you. And depending on the level of your development, that is where you go to in the astral or the causal or absorption completely into divine consciousness. But it all exists right within you. Right now you have the physical, you have the astral, you have the causal. And this is what Master came to teach us, is to how to take out the cork of ignorance from those three bodies, the physical body, the astral or the electrical, the energy body, the causal or the idea, the mental body, and to allow spirit to escape into pure spiritual freedom. Yesterday we had our wonderful time in silence, our Silent Saturday. And it's always a wonderful time to get together with other devotees, and there's something about taking the time to go deeper. When you meditate for 15, 20 minutes, a half an hour, it's all right. It's good. It's a positive thing. But you don't go deep enough during that time. Master used to say, when others get up from meditation, I'm just beginning. You can imagine Master knocking at the doors of heaven, Mother knocking at the doors of the heaven. They're persistent. They're pests. They won't go away. God finally has to answer them just to get them to calm down a bit. Let there be a little bit of peace in heaven again. Can we be that way? Can we be persistent? Can we put our whole heart, mind, and soul into the venture? Can we let go of our littleness, our fears, our distractions, our desire nature, just long enough to put ourselves completely and totally at the feet of God? Imagine yourself just for a moment being in Master's yearning heart. We were listening to some of his chants and prayers before we started the talk today in honoring him. And you can hear in his voice, there is no wimpiness about him. There is no going back and forth. It's all or nothing. A disciple once described St. Francis to me. And he said, you know, we were speaking at nighttime. It was about 10 or 10:30. We'd been meditating together. And he said, St. Francis is like this. If he heard about Master and he knew that Master was living down in Los Angeles right now, he'd get out and he'd start walking down the freeway right now. 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night, wouldn't make any difference. No money, nothing. He wouldn't care. He organized himself 100% in order to go to God. And we know from Master's descriptions that he did the same thing, that Mother did the same thing, that Papa did the same thing. When you look at their lives, very different personalities. But they had one thing in common. They knew what they wanted, and they were willing to go after it. And they had to face criticism. Mother was not always understood by those who were around her. She is not always understood by disciples. She is not always understood by family. And yet it did not deter her one bit. How many of us shy away because of criticism that others might level towards us? How many of us would be embarrassed to be socially known as our true spiritual selves? These are things we have to get beyond. We have to get past. Now, we don't have to dress in strange clothes with strange names and go out onto the street and advertise it in that way, but we should not be embarrassed. We should not have it in our minds that there is any shame associated with who we are or what we do. We should let our light shine. And in Master, we have such a tremendous example. He once was taking his bath, as a ritual is to do in India, down at the river. And he is coming back from the Ganges, and there's a swish of his cloth, or so he thought in his mind. Actually, he had forgotten his copan, his only piece of clothing that he had taken down there with him. He was in such an ecstatic mode with God. His aunt saw him walking along on the street, and she said, "You sinful creature," and she walked up and she slapped him because he is walking naked. And he looked straight in her eyes and he said, "The sin is in you. I had none in my mind. I merely forgot my cloth." And he turned around and he walked back to get his cloth. But he was unmindful of his state. He was once walking with a friend, and he is talking about the universal vision and how everything is God to the yogi who has realized it. And so the friend looked over and he saw some disgusting rice that had been cooking out in the sun and was rotten, had maggots in it. And he said, "What about that?" He points to the rice. "Is that God? Why don't you eat some?" Master said, "All right." He went over, took up a scoop in his hand, and he started chewing it. He said, "Oh, this is so delicious. It's filled with God." Now, you don't have to go around eating things out of garbage cans and off the street. But you get the point. Where God becomes a more preeminent reality than your social convictions, than your physiological convictions, than all the things that you have clung to. God becomes the most important thing in the world. Master used to say that if I believe sincerely 100% that I was with God and the whole rest of the world were against me, I would stand with God. That's quite a statement. It's not easy to have the whole world against you, not have anybody in your court, nobody on your side. But that is how he felt. And you know what? He drew those who were also God-oriented towards him. When he was in school, they used to call him the mad monk. Now, I'm sure this was not always meant kindly. It was in jest, but maybe also a little bit of a pinch in there, or an attempt at a pinch. But he was dedicated. He used to bring those around to his master. In his second year or second stage of his university schooling, it was near Sri Yukteswar's, and he would bring him by. And Sri Yukteswar had said an interesting thing to Master when they first met. He said, "Never avoid me. I want you to promise that." Master took a very solemn vow never to avoid Sri Yukteswar. He would bring his friends by. And, you know, Master may have been thinking a little highly of himself at the time and what a great disciple he was. And, of course, he was also holding out what a great master he had. And Sri Yukteswar would start in on Master in front of his friends. "Why don't you do this? Why are you so lax about this? Why aren't you..." And on it went. It was a beating. and Master would take it. Now, that's not an easy thing to do when you bring your friends around. You think you're going to have a nice time of it, you know, a little cup of tea and have some nice conversation. Hopefully everybody feels the same way about your Master as you do. And then you get that kind of treatment. That's not easy. But there's a very deep reason, I think, and it's what God showed me, that Master coming to the West would take some beatings. He would take some real hardships. It would really take a stalwart soul in order for him to maintain and to continue here in the West. He wouldn't always have friends. And he had to know where he stood with God. Was he willing to stand with God and Guru, even when the world did not stand with him? And Master bore up against every one of Sri Yukteswar's, you might say, call them beatings in a way. Mother said something similar about Swami Ramdas, that he loved me enough to hurt me. And you think, oh, well, how's that spiritual? How is that? But it's what's necessary in the moment in order to help that one to attain something higher. I feel that in myself. There are times when I can be very tough with somebody. There are times when I put somebody out in left field, and I know they want more from me, and I don't give it to them. Now, it's not I who makes that decision. It is that internal God, that divine being within. And he decides. He decides. And I go according to him. And if he's my boss, and he's my only boss, then I'm out to please only one. And isn't that a relief? That you don't have to please this entire world. You don't have to please everybody who might find fault with you, or cringe that they might find fault with you. It's a very interesting thing that sometimes those who are your worst critics end up being your most loyal friends. Because once they test you, but once they get it, they're really there. They're really there. So you do not get dismayed at such things, and you certainly do not ever turn away from God. And Master never did. Never did. And we are all the recipients of the grace. Now, I never met Master in body. Neither have any of the rest of us. But we have met him in spirit. If we have dived deep into meditation. I remember before I went into Cloud Mountain for the year of silence and solitude, that I was at a store and they had some beautiful bells. I have them still. They're wire bent in the shape of the Om, and then the bells hang from the Om. And as I was looking at it, I was thinking, oh, that might be a nice thing for the cabin where I'm going to be staying at Cloud Mountain. And just at that moment, I heard Master's voice so clearly that when you hear the bells, you will always think of me. And it was true. Anytime I'd be sitting in meditation, I would hear the wind, or not even hear the wind, but I'd hear the tinkle of the bells moved by the wind. And I'd always think of Master and his promise. And it was such a lovely feeling, and it was such a lovely thought. And then one night I had been in deep meditation for a long time. And I suddenly heard those bells. And it seemed different this time somehow. And when I looked up, to my stark amazement, there was Master and there was Mother. And they had such joy. I only wish that I could convey directly to you what it was to be with them in that moment. And one of them would start to laugh, and the vibration started down, it seemed like down in their belly area. And it would just radiate out, and the other one would start to laugh too. It was like two tuning forks, and one would start vibrating, and the other one would start vibrating. And the joy and the mirth would just vibrate out. Such love and such joy, I cannot tell you. And what a blessing I melted and melted into thousands of pieces, and then when there is no pieces left, I just continued to melt in this ocean of joy and mirth and such love, such radiance. When you know a master in such a way, you know them as the very purity of God. Because in spirit, that spiritual master and God have become one. And there is no difference. You cannot find it. And yet here is a miraculous thing. Each one who has taken incarnation in this way maintains a certain signature, you might say, in their vibration. There's a personality that's there. You recognize it. You recognize master as master, mother as mother, papa as papa, even though it is totally pure and one in God. And so it begins to teach you that God is perfectly one, expressing himself as individuality or universality. That there is no difference in God consciousness. Now, the human mind has a difficult time wrapping itself around that, but it's true. It is true. And you are that. Now, you cannot just say, well, I am God, without having had the experience and really make it stick. You can know it intuitively, you can feel it, you can sense it, the truth of it. But you yourself have not yet become one with that truth. But through the ways and the means that Master has brought to us and Mother, we have the most perfect tools in order to attain that sonship with God. But we have to employ those tools. We have to become artists with those tools. We have to learn the deeper methods of the tools. When you practice Hong Sa, you can go so far, you can go all the way to God with Hong Sa. You can feel the vibrancy, the purity, the perfection of spirit by practicing of Hong Sa and just going deeper and deeper into the silence with it. You know, silence is a difficult word because oftentimes we associate silence with death. Death is silent, isn't it? The person doesn't speak or move or make any noise anymore. But silence in God is not death. It's a death of ignorance of our separation from God. If you think about whatever you love the most, whatever you're more passionate about in this life, and you think of that as a tiny, 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 infinitesimal aspect of God, because God created everything that is. And you go from some reflected aspect of God through your passion, through your hobby, through your interest. And you're, when you go directly to God, you are plugging directly into the current that created that tiny little aspect. You are going to the source of all life, all intelligence, all wisdom. Everything that is. Now, isn't that worth making a little bit of effort for? But we wake up in the morning, oh, I'm so tired. I don't want to get up early. Oh, I'm not going to be able to meditate very long this morning. But, you know, I worked so hard yesterday. I deserve a little bit more. And your love affair with the mattress continues. Why don't we see the possibilities? What does God have for me today? What does he have in store for me today? Can I delve further into the transcendent truth and have something revealed to me that will change my life today and bring me into a state of realization I have never known before? You see how we create a circumference around us artificially. And say, well, I think, you know, it's going to take me a long time to get realization. Might as well pace myself, you know. Can't get in too big of a hurry about this because it's going to take a long time, maybe lots of lifetimes. So I'm just going to kind of go a little easy and smooth and cool here. And you see how we push it away. Whether we do it consciously or unconsciously, we do it the same. And would we not run to God if we really believed that this was just hiding behind the veil, just peeking out through the veil, that we would not be seeking God if God did not seek us first, is ready to reveal himself to us. But we yawn and stretch and roll back over and go to sleep for a while more, to dream this dream of delusion rather than awakening. It is a great, great mystery. It really is. It really is. And so we need to have the imagination. We need to have the vision. We need to have the feeling that there is something tremendous emerging inside of us. And it needs our cooperation, not our distraction, in order to enter into that. When you think of avoiding God, when you think of not making the effort, put yourself in the skin of Master. And then think, what would Master do? What would he think about this? And I think the answer gets pretty clear very fast. Master could be very tough, you know, very tough. He could really call people to account. And Mother would say he would call people out during service. He would name people's names. And without having necessarily ever talked to them, he would pull out what they were doing and say, stop it. Get on track. Get on track. This is what we must do for ourselves. Until we have that ever new joy bubbling up within us on a constant basis, that is how Sri Yukteswar defined God realization. And I'll tell you, Sri Yukteswar is very tough on Master, and we get it in the autobiography, the way that Master writes about it. But when I was at Puri, where there is the Mahasamadhi site of Sri Yukteswar, they buried his body in the ground in the lotus position and then buried him and built a temple over the top of it. And I was there at that Mahasamadhi site. And I can tell you the vibration there is tremendous, tremendous. And I felt such joy, such joy. And the clear thought that came to me was that when Master was told by Sri Yukteswar during the resurrection of Sri Yukteswar that he would no longer be stern with Master, but that he felt perhaps maybe he had even been too stern with him. And Master said, no, every one of those things you did to me were like guardian angels. Please, even scold me now. And his Master wouldn't. He didn't have it in him. And what Sri Yukteswar revealed through my own mind was that that was not only true for Master, that was true for all of us. There's something that changed in the outer expression of Sri Yukteswar. And now such a predominant aspect of him is joy, a bubbling up joy. And so it is with God. And Sri Yukteswar said, God consciousness, God realization is the knowledge, is the awareness of ever new joy. So until you have ever new joy with you constantly, you've got work to do. Swami Satchidananda would say, more sadhana, more sadhana, more spiritual practice. So you have your measuring stick. You have your measuring stick. Do you have ever new joy? Do you feel that purity and attunement with God on a constant basis? And if not, work harder. Feel what Master would feel, that driving force. Feel what he came to awaken in each one of us without compromise and without exception. And you will enjoy that God consciousness. It is the greatest thing that you can ever tap into. And it will change your life never to be the same. This is the fulfillment of why Master came. And you will honor him, his life, his memory, his spirit the best and in the highest way by attaining the same state that he attained. Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am he. Bow to the light within you.